Welcome to Clap with Jane with Jane Clap. I know some of the most interesting and inspiring people who are helping to keep humanity afloat in their own unique ways. I want you to meet them too. I wish to acknowledge the land on which I operate. For thousands of years, it has been the traditional land of the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and most recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River. Today, this meeting place is still home to many Indigenous peoples from across Turtle Island, and I am grateful to have the opportunity to work on this land. It would be an understatement to express how honored I am to have Rebecca Price on the podcast. Rebecca is a wellness advocate and yoga instructor that draws on her wealth of knowledge of working in underserved, marginalized, racialized, and immigrant communities in Canada, the United States, and the Caribbean. In 2015, Rebecca founded I Rise Yoga and Wellness as a way to connect, promote, and bring awareness to, and foster the inclusion of people of color and other historically marginalized groups in yoga and wellness spaces. Rebecca's work is rooted in an intersectional understanding of power and harnessing the tools and resources to facilitate community change. With over 20 years in the not-for-profit sector as a community development and engagement specialist, Rebecca has worked on and developed strategies and policies related to diversity and inclusion, equity, conflict resolution, settlement, and integration in creating safe, cohesive communities. Rebecca uses her lived experience as a woman of color and her unique expertise in community development and engagement to bring and address the gap of diversity in the wellness industry through workshops and many other incredible offerings. I'm so excited for you to meet her if you don't know of her incredible work already. Hi, everybody. I have the freaking amazing Rebecca Price today to chat with us. I can't wait for you to meet Rebecca as well. We're both Torontonians. Rebecca, thank you so much for making time to talk to me today.
Thanks for inviting me and having me. I've been actually looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, we've been talking about this conversation for a bit, and I'm just really grateful you're making the time to share, and so that more people and my audience can meet you and beyond. Is there anything you want people to know about you before I ask some questions?
To know about me? I am here because I want to create change, right? Mm-hmm. And change looks like so many different things and so many different levels, and in terms of like how I would show up for community, how I show up as a parent, I could show up as a partner, just really change the dynamics of how we show up. So change maker. I'm here to make change. Mm-hmm. That's what I'll say today.
Let's start with talking about the Well Collective. Last month marked the first anniversary of the Well Collective, which is working to decolonize and shift the wellness narrative. How's the first year been, and how's COVID changed things for you and your vision of how to do this?
So I would say that our first year was full of learnings and about really reinforcing our intentions. Myself and my co-founder, Shezna, and I spent about a year prior to us like implementing the Well Collective. We spent like a whole year in terms of just planning out our work and making sure it was representative of community. And basically with our backgrounds working in community, we really wanted to be specific in terms of making sure that our intentions were clearly met. And so I feel like on that level, our intentions in terms of making sure that we had an opportunity to really deconstruct and also dismantle some of the systems that we were talking about through our work, and providing opportunity for marginalized communities and BIPOC wellness practitioners to participate in it. So when I look at it from that perspective, I feel that we were really successful in doing that. We received like a lot of really great feedback when we did our pop-up. It was really neat because it was like a pop-up inside of a pop-up. Mm-hmm. And it was focused on the idea of like, what does it mean to be well? And who has the right to show up to be well, what's the language around wellness, who gets to teach us to be well, because wellness is about teaching and all those kinds of things. So I feel that, you know, it was a really good platform for us to kind of launch on. I think that in terms of the impact on our reach, it was good for community with respect to providing space for community to access, see themselves represented, as well as for community who aren't racialized to see how, like, this for them, that was the first time they've even had like a BIPOC teacher in general. And I think the other part for it was that it was really empowering for our BIPOC teachers, because this was the first time that they've even taught to their own community, like seeing themselves reflected back when they're in front of a space, as well as also be empowered to know that community sees them as a resource and would like to have them, like, have space for them further, like in terms of continuing. So I think when we were looking at it from that way, we've had subtle impact in terms of, like, you know, one of our practitioners, he kind of always hid behind like the guise of like his brand was very white presenting, even though he's like Black and he's male and he's dark skin. And so, you know, he started to dismantle why that he was doing that, because he understood that his Blackness was seen as a barrier and a challenge to get clients and things like that. And so if he presented a white face, then people would actually come to his stuff. And then when they got there, it was too late. Like, he provided a really great experience for everybody, right? And then how could he kind of like dismantle the way the systems and structures that were placed on him, for instance, that allowed him to internalize his oppression. And so it was really neat to see these kinds of learnings also unfold amongst our practitioners too as well, because it created a different kind of narrative in terms of the ways that they wanted to show up, the ways that they wanted to be actively engaged and support community too as well, which you typically might not see in any other kind of circumstances. And then I think that, you know, COVID really highlighted some of the stuff that we traditionally see is gaps in community, right? And so, like, you know, the conversation about Black and brown communities being disproportionately overrepresented in terms of people getting sick with COVID, dying from COVID, is no different than the overrepresentation of Black, Indigenous, and people of color in general when it comes to, like, you know, shortcomings with the health system, medical system, access to resources and things like that. And so I think for us, because we've had that background in community development for over 20 years, we were able to broach important conversations in wellness that we saw as gaps, mm-hmm. right? So, like, have important conversations on privilege. What does that mean, right? From a wellness perspective, right? Have important conversations on anti-Blackness. Like, and so, like, when you're looking at it from those ways, it was just like really thinking about where are some gaps? How is the wellness industrial complex a system that kind of like occupies a space that reinforces privileges, reinforces systemic, institutional and individual oppressions? And then also, like, having, like, important conversations about how the wellness industry holds a lot of space for appropriation of, like, Indigenous knowledge and modalities and healing, what it means to appropriate from specific cultures, like having a hip-hop yoga class, like all those kinds of things without, like, you're financially gaining, but how are you giving back to the communities that you're borrowing from and crediting these communities? And also helping us really understand the ways that we clearly operate within a capitalist framework and, you know, how the wellness industry also perpetuates this constant idea that there's something wrong with you. And what does that mean when you're someone who operates on the margins, who comes from a place of constantly being othered, and that, you know, how, you know, it also reinforces like colonial mindsets around like access, hierarchies around like what's right, what's not right, who's deemed worthy and all those kinds of things. So, and how these processes make things really inaccessible. So I feel like we were able to have and start these kinds of conversations, which provided wellness practitioners a space to really be reflective about the work that they were doing, how they were doing the work that they're doing, how they could also kind of like show up differently.
Mm-hmm. Do you work with like white wellness people to help someone like me see how we're participating in the wellness industrial complex and really not doing a great job in how we show up?
Yes. So for us, the community, like, so my co-founder, just full transparency, Shazana, she's white. Mm-hmm. We encourage community, right? Because part and parcel of dismantling, like if we're like even thinking about like post-colonial theory and the ways in which that kind of shows up through work, dismantling requires a collective effort, right? And so on some levels, like dismantling for me might look like something different for you as a white woman, but like I have also internalized oppressions and things like that I need to work on at an individual, also at a collective community level. And so we've opened up these discussions for everyone because, you know, the other part is that the wellness industry is predominantly white, right? And so you kind of need to involve the people who are controlling the elements to be a part of that conversation, and providing the space for them to like be reflective and providing them with the opportunities to kind of re-engage and critically look at the ways that their work is showing up. And figuring out ways to be able to dismantle that, right? And then also the flip side of that is if you're BIPOC or coming from a marginalized community, like how do you dismantle those systems without replicating those systems, right? Because I think sometimes it's easy just to say I'm providing space, but just because you provide space, or if you're a yoga studio that hires like someone who's Black, doesn't mean that you're changing the system. You're just maybe reinforcing it in a different way and kind of change the face of who's there, but it's the same system, right? And so how do we collectively engage in a larger concept of what community is and then who's involved in the creation or co-creation of that community? And when you're looking at it that way, then everybody needs to kind of show up to the table to reimagine mm-hmm. what that table or that space environment can look like.
Mm-hmm. That's really emotionally intense work to be a part of, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I do a lot of yoga, meditation, drink a lot of tea and go for a lot of walks. And days are better than other days. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Are there any lessons that you're taking from 2020, like into this year?
I think the lessons that I'm taking from 2020 is that there's more work to be done. I feel that for me, looking from the outside in, a lot of 2020 was very performative, right? Like, I feel like people kind of occupy this space of like, you know, okay, like COVID happened and then people are talking about the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and all these kinds of things. And it just was really great to and convenient for people to post like a black square or hashtag BLM and all those kinds of things and be complacent with that and not move beyond that and like read a book or two and not really work on the other elements that require in terms of decentering and dismantling. And so for me, I think I saw a lot of performative actions. Mm-hmm. And when doing this work, and it's an emotional space and seeing all those performative actions, like it was very hard for me to like process. And I've talked about like how that has caused not just me harm, but other people harm too as well. And how that on some levels makes you kind of become a little disillusioned. It's like, why am I even doing this work if, you know, people aren't really showing up to the party to like party. They're just showing up to the party because they know that someone's going to be there with a camera and take their picture. Right. And so like, you know, 2020 really reinforced the idea of like, you can plant the seeds, but you have to spend more time watering them in order for some sort of plant to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And really finding ways to like really engage in these important conversations in a manner that's accessible for people to understand why it's relevant and important to them. You know, sometimes people live in this space of like, it's not me, it's them. They keep like other themselves and other others at the same time. And so therefore they may not feel like the rules are applicable to them. Or they might feel like the space is overwhelming in terms of the amount of work that they have to do and just kind of like abdicate responsibility because like, who wants to do that mental, emotional, spiritual, physical workout? Like, you know? And so I think 2020 has really demonstrated the importance of really encouraging and continuing the importance of these conversations, having these conversations with intentionality, as well as just really thinking about and encouraging community show up differently and be that change.
You know, I can honestly say that if I hadn't made mistakes in public, there's several relationships that I wouldn't have built with people.
Yeah.
Like as a white person, and when I've gotten called in, and there's been like this deepening of relationship with really incredible human beings that if I hadn't messed up and I hadn't been called in, and you know, and that emotional labor spent in calling me in, I can just think about how it's changed me personally, like just to have these relationships develop as a result of that, that ultimately like are so life affirming in the end. So,
and like Sonya Renee Taylor talks about like radical love, right? And the how love, like that, even occupying that space is like uncomfortable, right? And even all of us as like wellness practitioners, there's a level of discomfort that's involved in our work, right? As a yoga teacher, like, you know, there's positions that are uncomfortable. If someone's doing Reiki, there's stuff that might come up that might make people feel uncomfortable, like trauma work, clearly. Mm-hmm. Uncomfortable spaces, like, you know what I mean? So looking at the different ways that wellness manifests itself through the practices that we all collectively teach, there inherent to that is the idea of discomfort, right? And so it's okay when the discomfort is, you know, we're like, you know, breathe into it, like work your way through it, like all that kind of stuff. But when the discomfort rests right here, like in your heart and in your stomach, and then you just kind of want to run away from it and not really confront that. And so like being radical about having like change requires us to live in, breathe through, and work through uncomfortable spaces, right? Because that's the only way you're going to get to the other side, right? And so as we practice this as teachers, we tell people like, you can work through it. Then we also have to have that same mentality when it comes to our work, when we're trying to say like, okay, like how am I dismantling and how am I like decolonizing my practice, and how I'm, you know, when we have these conversations, then we also have to understand that there has to be, it's inherently important for us to go through phases and spaces of discomfort. Because then if it's not uncomfortable, then you're really not doing the work. And sometimes we get so comfortable with comfort that when we feel discomfort, we just want to like abdicate responsibility for that and just run away from it.
I have so many things I want to ask you, and some things coming up for me right now, and the way that the wellness industry has created this idea that I need to be healthy and calm and blissful in my own body. Right. And this is a part of what I think has been super toxic about wellness, is that we aren't looking at wellness as a function of relationships and wellness as a collective experience. And it's like, I'm going to be healthy and flexible and drink green juice and go to yoga classes. And that's the definition of wellness, instead of like how we show up in community and how we face all of our shit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, I always like, you know, Biggie Smalls, like, more money, more problems. Like, you can become super flexible, drink all the green juice. You can do all these things. And like you said, your shit's still not handled, right? Like, you're not like, you have a really nice house built on a very rocky foundation, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and part of the reason why, like, the wellness, I call it like an industrial complex, because it is, because it's inherently telling you something's wrong with you, right? And that you are broken. And it's coming from this colonial mentality of, like, you are fundamentally flawed and therefore, right? And, you know, if we're occupying that space, like, we call them self-help books, right? Like, because we need help, right? Like, the language in wellness within, amongst even the practices also needs to kind of, like, be decolonized too as well. Like, but, you know, that's another conversation. But, like, in terms of just looking at the ways that it plays out for us and thinking that, you know, everything is surface level, right? So I've become more flexible. My skin looks flawless because I'm drinking all this green juice and I'm very regular because I got all that fiber, but I'm not doing all the inner work that's required for me to really, like, unpack. I'm not doing the inner work that's required for me to, like, heal too, mm-hmm. as well, right? And, like, having those epiphanies and working through those things, right, mm-hmm. are the things that are inherently going to make you a quote unquote better person or show up differently with respect to community. It's not you being able to get into the splits and do a handstand and chug back, like, you know, intermittent fast your way through life, like,
and meditate every day for 20 minutes, right?
Right. And if you don't, then there's something wrong with you. No, there's nothing wrong. And for me, when I, in community, I've been teaching for 10 years and specifically BIPOC community. And I think that because I'm occupying a space of continuously being othered, it's really important for me to teach community or hold space with community to tell them that, like, it's okay. How you show up is how you show up, and there's nothing wrong with you, because you spend your whole life being told and navigating spaces that tell you that you're inferior, that there's something wrong, right? And these are practices that we're coming to help heal us, to help us make us feel better. And so as a teacher, it's my responsibility to really unpack that and look at how I'm holding space in that way. Either I have an opportunity to reinforce that, or I have an opportunity to deconstruct that and learn from that. So allow my students also to be a teacher to me, right? And vice versa, make it a reciprocal relationship. But, you know, sometimes I feel like we forget that when we're in these spaces, but it's, like, a really important component of our work.
Yeah, like, so much of your work centers around, like, concepts of mutual aid and community care. Mm-hmm. And that's how you really define wellness in general, right?
Yeah, I look at, like, so I would say there's the we, the collective we in wellness, like we. Yes. Like, you know, like, if we look at words, let's deconstruct them. Language is really important. And so if we center we, right, in the wellness piece, then understanding that means that our ability to be well is interconnected, right? It's the idea of community. A lot of these practices that are inherently indigenous to certain cultures centers the idea of community, right? Even the idea of showing up to eat food is a community practice in some cultures, right? Like, it's not just an individual thing. I think that when we come to the West, that's when it has become an individual practice, which again goes back to that whole colonial piece about centering the individual, like that whole capitalistic piece around, like, pull yourself up by the bootstraps is the individual. If you work really hard, you can get somewhere. And so if we kind of take a step back and look at the language and be like, okay, like, my, like, even if we look at breath, I breathe out, you breathe in. Right? You need me to breathe like the trees, right? And so, like, we're all interconnected through practices, whether we want to, like, acknowledge it or not. And so for me, wellness has to center the collective we, right? And a lot of these practices, like, when I talk about community care, when I talk about, like, mutual aid, when I talk about that, it's about looking at the ways in which we could show up differently as a practice of community. Right? And, like, even when I think about the spaces that I've been in, when I've gone to studios and places to practice, it sometimes feels, I mean, really sterile. Like, there's no sense of community. There's no, like, hey, Jane, how are you? Like, what's good? Like, you know, and you talking to someone else who's talking to somebody else, like that collective, like I've managed to cultivate space in the places that I've taught where it's like, everybody knows their name. They buy you a card when you have a baby. They notice when you haven't been in that class for 2 weeks, right? They check in on each other outside of me, like being in that space, right? And so like, you know, that is collectivity. That's the whole idea of community care. Like, and community care or like connection to community is one of the pillars of like the social determinants of health and like how it impacts your well-being, mm-hmm. right? And we live in a more increasingly disconnected society. And then we like add on the pandemic where they talk about social distancing, where I say physical distancing, because just because we're physically distant doesn't mean we have to be socially distant. So how can we still can create these channels where we're centering community, involving community? And a lot of social justice practices or movements were predicated on the idea of like collective community care and mutual aid, like the Black Panther Party. And so like, how are like these things now showing back up, like community fridges, mutual aid, right? How are people deciding to check in on their neighbors, like community care? And then as we, as wellness practitioners, then how do we change the way we operate and function as businesses to be able to kind of really build those tenets into our work, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as much as we've been in this space of pivoting and, you know, looking at the way that we function as a business, it's also an opportunity for us to look at the ways that we could do better, right? Looking at the ways that we could kind of step away from the platform of centering the individual and looking at the collective, right? Mm-hmm. Looking at the ways that we could share and reallocate our resources so that it is benefiting more than just the one person, right? We don't need to hoard it all, because when you die, like, you can't take all that shit with you anyways, right? Mm-hmm. And so like really having that understanding and why that's important, especially if you're going all the way back to when all these practices that we've appropriated and borrowed and brought over here are centering the idea of collective community, then you really need to like honor that, right? And like, you know, honor it in terms of it, like decolonizing it from that perspective, and then honoring and looking at it, the like, how do you make it a practice that really focuses and centers the indigenous cultures from what it came from too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's about really stepping back and seeing where all these healing practices are meant to actually create more community and collectivity versus living in these individual systems, i.e. our own bodies that are healthy on their own, which is near impossible, really.
Yeah, I mean, babies aren't born by themselves. They occupy a space within you for so long and they depend on you. And what I do, what I put into my body impacts the outcomes, right? And how I put in, what I put into my children's bodies after they're here on this planet also impacts outcomes too, right? And so like really looking at the ways that we can help or harm. Right. And so when I'm talking about community care, when I'm talking about mutual aid, I'm really essentially asking you, you have two choices. You have the choice to help or you have the choice to harm. And when you recognize you have those two choices, what are you going to be doing and how are you going to be choosing that? Especially now that, like, you know, people are waking up to understanding different kinds of systems and how they impact the livelihoods and well-being of others, right? Mm-hmm. And now that you know that, like you have an opportunity to kind of reinforce structures and systems that create harm, or you have an opportunity to dismantle those structures and recreate new ones that create opportunities to help, right? Empower, which are different.
Yeah, it's sort of like the cost of falling back asleep once we have woken up, but the cost of falling back asleep is, I think, massive for each one of us individually as well.
If you feel like you have something to lose, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part where a lot of people don't necessarily feel like there's a loss for them, right? Like if you've been operating in this state, this sense of privilege, which we all have privileges, right? Like, am I losing, right? And sometimes I think when people think about waking up or becoming quote unquote woke, and I use that word loosely in parentheses, they feel like they're losing something, right? Without looking at the bigger picture in terms of like the other gains that could come out of it. And so sometimes I think that people occupy that space of just like, whether or not it goes back to the idea of like that comfort, that discomfort, whether or not they want to live in that and work through it, or they're just like, oh, this feels really awkward. I'm not about this life. Peace out. I'm just going to go back to what I was doing, which is why I'm really afraid of like that performative piece and how that shows up, because we're so used to seeing that. I look at it from maybe a community background, because I've also been a part of those systems and structures that have like, we write a grant for 2 years and we help community for those 2 years, and then there's no sustainability, right? And then what happens? And then people fall through the cracks again, because we're not really committed to doing the actual work to create effective change, right? We're just doing stuff to make the Band-Aid last a little longer, but not really working on ways to heal the wound or prevent the wound in the first place.
Yeah, that brings me to that what you talk about with intentions, you know, like setting intentions for the year, and how you can feel when things are performative, you don't feel the deeper intentions behind it. Like, how can you, what does it feel like, if you don't mind me asking, to be around somebody who is saying the right things, but you can tell, you can feel that their intentions aren't really there? Like, what does your bullshit meter feel like to you?
If anybody knows me, they know me to call them out on. I'll call you out on your bullshit. I will tell you that it's bullshit. I'm very clear about stating my agenda, right? And I also don't have time to waste, right? I really don't have time to waste on that. And so I will call you out on things like, is this difficult for you because you're afraid? You feel like you have something to lose? Is this difficult for you because you just don't believe in it? Like, I will honor it with those words. I'll be very specific, depending on how my bullshit meter reads you, right? I think I have a very strong intuition, which some people like, some people don't. And so, you know, and for me to be able to engage you in conversation, my hope is that you are committed, right? And I've seen and experienced, even up until recently, people say that they are committed to the work, but not really, really committed to the work. And so I think that, you know, setting intentions is really important, because, and that's why I always say to people, like, goals. Like, if you're making diversity, equity, and inclusion a goal, right? Because, you know, I do a lot of work around the whole diversity, equity, inclusion. If you're making it a goal, then you're setting yourself up for failure. But if you're intentionally saying, and then that looks different. So a goal would be like, I want to diversify my company. I want to diversify my wellness space, okay? And an intention is, I'm going to hire 3 BIPOC individuals by said date, right? And here are the ways that I'm going to support them throughout this whole entire process. Because I also acknowledge that there are systemic factors that are in place that may prohibit them being able to engage with my space safely, to encourage community to come and engage with them safely within the context of my space. I also understand that opportunities aren't extended to them the same way that opportunities and privilege has allowed me to be in this space, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, there's a big difference. I'm intentionally setting this is my standard, this is where I want to go, rather than just making a broad-ranged blanket statement, right? Because there's no intentionality in terms of the work and understanding of the work that's required for you to do, mm-hmm. right? And so when I am in spaces and I have these conversations with people, I also am just like, what's your agenda? Like, what do you really want to get out of this? And be real with me. If you just want to look good, then clearly I won't be the person that you want to work with. And I appreciate that because I also don't want someone to leverage my name and my emotional labor, because it's emotional labor that I'm investing in at helping you unpack and dismantle into something that you're really not committed to, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think when we're looking at intentionality, it's about really centering the idea of the commitment and acknowledging that that commitment is going to take a lot of work, and it's nothing that happens overnight, right? And so, even for me as an individual, like some of the things that I might be practicing for myself and then working in community, understanding that it's a process, it's a journey. We have the word practice for a reason. Like, I used to play sports and I always just be like, it's a practice. Like, you can't, like, I always tell my kids, like, you can't wake up and dunk overnight. If you could, then I wouldn't be working right now. You know what I mean? Like, I would be doing something else in my time. But, like, I just think that, really looking at the language that we're using when we're trying to create different spaces and reshape and reimagine is really important. And the word intentionality, because intentionality lives within, right? Intentionality acknowledges that there's going to be ebbs and flows, ups and downs. And intentionality doesn't necessarily set you up for failure, because you recognize that within the process, it's inherently flawed. So there will be, room for that. And it allows you to practice more compassion towards yourself, towards others, that doesn't necessarily find its way in other parts of languages that we use when we're talking about the things that we talk about or spaces that we're trying to create.
Mm. Yeah, this sort of brings me to this idea too around in how your bullshit meter can track things. And you said recently in a post on Instagram about self-care, your self-care looks like acknowledging the mistakes we've made, the toxic people we let in, and valuing all experiences, not just the ones that make us feel good. And you also said our healing shouldn't be curated in order to be digestible. And this only comes from having done a lot of personal work mm-hmm. for yourself. Is there anything you'd like to share, like, more about this or all the discomfort you've had to go through to be able to speak to things the way you are right now?
I think that for me, I have really been focusing on the idea of self-compassion, right? And self-compassion as a pathway to self-liberation, right? So we have these conversations all the time. What does that really look like for us, right? And so for me, I need to be authentic with myself and I need to be honest with myself. And so that means, you know what? I haven't made the best choices, right? I haven't necessarily let the right people in. And if I'm cultivating that and rooting in a practice of self-compassion, it's like also acknowledging that that's okay, right? Because then I'm learning from all the experiences, not just the ones, like I said, that make me feel good, right? And I think that sometimes because, the idea of self-care, especially within wellness, is really rooted in that idea of being fundamentally flawed, we always are going to just, not acknowledge all the grimy pieces to our existence, right? Because that would require us being uncomfortable, and we don't want to be uncomfortable, right? And so for me, I have spent a lot of time really honoring and acknowledging those spaces in between that have required me to heal from harm, heal from trauma, or continue to heal from trauma, continue to heal from pain, continue to heal from harm that has been caused to me and that I also actively and willingly engaged in as a participant, because I also need to hold space and honor that too as well. And I think that when you do that, then the language around how you show up and how you interface with people changes, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an important part. And I always say, like, you know, especially because we spend so much time on social media, that's why I talk about curating it, right? Like, we want to show up in a way where we pick and choose the parts of us that we want to share, right? And sometimes the parts that we need to share are the parts that we want to hide, right? Mm-hmm. Because hiding those makes us feel comfortable, but acknowledging those things are also really important to helping someone else or helping ourselves through that passage of healing. And so if we're only curating, like, you know, experiences on a square that people hurt because that's the way we validate ourselves, then we're not being honest with ourselves on the amount of work that we really need to do. And so, like, I have spent a lot of my time really looking at the ways that I can show up differently and be different and practice, like, self-liberation through self-compassion, right? Because the whole entire idea or purpose of us being here is to liberate, right? And I come from a long lineage of people who have intentionally tried to liberate themselves. Like, my great-great-grandfather was a enslaved person who ran away from slavery and liberated himself and a whole village of people, right? And so that's in my blood. Yeah, like, it's like literally in my blood, in my DNA. And I think that any people that come from a history of resistance, right, that idea of liberation is fundamental to who you are, because self compassion and self-liberation leads to the idea of self-sovereignty. And I inherently believe that all of us have the right to be, right? Whether or not you feel comfortable with me being here, but I have the right to be, I have the right to exist. And part of my existence means telling my story, right? Mm-hmm. Even the parts of my story that make me feel embarrassed, make me feel uncomfortable, they're just as important if not more important than the parts of my story that everybody wants to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. That's it, right? Like, it's about liberating ourselves from the confines of, like, the collective crap that we get sucked into and we lose our center and all of that. So it's like, as I'm listening to you speak, I'm like, yeah, the work in waking up for anybody white-bodied as well is to liberate yourself from how we unconsciously participate in the collective and lose ourselves in that process. We can't be in the fullness of who we are unless we start to decide how we're going to participate or not participate. If we're going to, I mean, that's what it really is about too, right? It's about personal liberation from the toxicity of the collective, right?
Yeah, and then, like, even as a white body person, just being able to acknowledge that, like, practicing self-compassion is just like, hey, like, I've benefited, right, from these systems. Whether or not I've willingly been an accomplice and, like, you know, and there's so many layers that we can go through with understanding that or unpacking that, but, like, I've gain some sort of privilege from these experiences or the spaces that my fact that I'm embodied in a white body allows me to navigate and experience this world differently, right? And so, like, and being okay with that, right? Being okay with the fact that, like, you know what, you actually are related to somebody who enslaved my ancestors, right? And you could do all the work, but you need to also like be compassionate towards yourself, forgive yourself, forgive your ancestors for that piece too as well, and then be like, okay, what can I do to dismantle that and reframe it and shift and move beyond that, right? Instead of just like running away from it, because then you're just curating this whole entire piece. Like, I'm this person who's been, is empty, like I'm an ally. And it's so easy to say that you're an ally, but an ally who's a true ally, an abolitionist, doesn't center themselves and call themselves that, right? You don't need to. And so, you know, just really looking at the ways that that impacts, and how you can practice that idea of compassion. And we're so good at practicing compassion to others, but not necessarily practicing compassion towards ourselves. Right?
That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true.
And again, that goes back to the idea of like, you know, how the wellness industry is set up in a way that, you know, doesn't provide us the grace or the space to honor ourselves in a way, or reframes that narrative that self-compassion is selfish, right? And so by doing that, you know, it prevents us from like intersecting with each other in a way that provides us the space to hold each other differently, right? And then it takes away that collective responsibility, because if I'm feeding myself and nurturing myself and pouring compassion into myself, then by default, I'm feeding you, I'm nourishing you, and I'm pouring into you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, you know, what comes to mind is what you said last March, almost a year ago, you shared the Bell Hooks quote, "When we choose to love, we choose to move against fear, against alienation and separation. The choice to love is the choice to connect, to find ourselves in the other." But it's really hard to do that when we're just beating ourselves up all the time, huh?
Yeah, it's totally. And that's what I'm saying, like, you know, that idea of practicing and just giving yourself grace. Like someone had asked me, I did like a talk and someone said, like, what's your mantra right now? And I'm like, my mantra is I'm doing the best that I can. Like, I'm in living life as a Black woman in the middle of a pandemic, who just recently went through a barrage of really bad health experiences in the medical system. And I'm just doing the best that I can, right? Because I know that I need to provide myself the grace to be able to just be where I'm at and how I'm at. And, you know, I'm also living in that space of being uncomfortable physically, emotionally, mentally, in my body too as well. And I'm doing the best that I can. And I think sometimes we have this idea of like, we can't just do our best. Like our best has to look like this. Like it's this grind, it's this, you know, and if you're not meeting all these expectations and you're falling short, but who are you falling short for, right? Mm-hmm. And so like the idea to be able to provide myself the opportunity to rest. Like, yes, it's resistance, but the idea for me to provide myself rest is also revolutionary, right? The idea for me to be able to be empathetic enough to see something in you that is reflection back in me, right? Is like revolutionary too within itself, right? And so like, you know, again, if we're looking at the idea of like the collective, right? And how we're all connected through the collective, then, you know, really showing up and practicing that way is like fundamental to who we would be as a human race.
What? So when you've experienced a lack of grace offered towards you from other people, mm-hmm. where, like, what's the source of the grace you offer yourself that you pull on? Like, where do you think that comes from? Because it's a question for myself too. It's like, how can I have self-compassion for myself when I'm up against situations that you know, are just mirroring back
you know, aspects of myself that are just broken, you know?
I think for me, I spent a lot of time working on it, and I still am working on it. Mm-hmm. I just have this resolve of not letting things break me, right? Mm-hmm. I have my surrender moments, and trust me, I sit in those feelings and I feel them or whatever, but I also kind of feel like because I haven't been provided the grace, because, you know, I've had a hard life, if I don't extend compassion and grace and look at myself with some sort of understanding, then how am I going to show up for myself? And more importantly, I think being a mother has helped shape me in terms of leading that by example for my children, right? Because I also understand, I can empathize, I can understand to an extent what it's like to be Black. I don't know what it's like to be a male, but I understand the reality that the world that my children are inheriting and going to be navigating through. And so I try to lead by this example, because it's really fundamentally important for them to learn different tools and have resources to them that allow them to facilitate and interact with their worlds a little bit differently. I just kind of like, sounds really weird. I just kind of like grew up where I was just like, these are my circumstances. This is what it is. But there has to be like a better way. There has to be like a better way. There has to be, if people are telling me that I'm continuously not worthy and I know that I'm worth something, then I need to just hold space for myself in a way that, you know, and I lived my life encapsulating my worth through other people's eyes. And the moment when I realized that my worth only matters to me, like how I see myself as worthy, and stopped looking for validation or stopped looking to prove myself, my worthiness to others, which is really hard when you are racialized, especially if you are Black and you came here as something that was commodified and your worth has always been dependent on how much you've been able to produce, right? To be able to understand that and deconstruct that and then reframe it in a way that my worth is contingent on me and who I am, not how you see me. I think that helps. It has helped me anyways, do things differently.
I feel like we're circling back to a huge reason why you created the Well Collective and why you do what you do, because you have this in you and this is what you want to foster in other people who might not have developed this capacity in themselves to hold your worth just inherent into who you are. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. 100%. And, you know, I also look at the idea of like wellness as being something that's intersectional, that's central to my work through iRise Yoga and through the Well Collective. It's about really acknowledging how things are intersectional. And if we're talking about that, then we need to really honor and hold space for that too as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, like how your work's combating oppression through intersectional wellness is a big part of what you do with iRise, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think on Instagram, I've gone off on a few tangents with those pieces, but I just kind of feel like, you know, when we're thinking about that idea of like intersectionality, right? And that's why I said, like, I can understand what it means to be Black, but I don't understand what it means to be a Black male. Like, I can protect my children as a Black mother. And seeing instances that have happened to the Black men that have been in my life, but I will never know what that feels like. And so that's what I'm saying, when we're looking at it from the perspective of like intersectionality, it's really about acknowledging that sometimes wellness as an industry has a very one-dimensional viewpoint of how we can intersect with like our well-being, and it doesn't necessarily impact the different ways in which we live our lives, right? And so it doesn't really impact the ways that we're living in spaces, through spaces, navigating through spaces, how we show up at a in a studio on a mat. And so because for me, and my understanding is that everything is intersectional, when you look at it, then, like I said before, like then that idea of wellness is very superficial, very surface level. And it doesn't take into account the other ways that like systems, whether they be like internal, systemic, individual, impacts our ability to be well, right? And so, like, for example, if we take the idea of like, I think at the beginning of COVID and even throughout COVID, there's this bigger conversation around like eating healthy and helping to build your immunity and all those kinds of things. But for me, it doesn't necessarily take into account like ways in which intersectionality comes into play. Like, you know, you're telling someone to eat healthy, but we're not looking at like environmental racism, for instance, and how that might play an important role in terms of access to healthy food, right? It doesn't take into account the role that our social economic status plays, right? It doesn't take into account our ability to purchase healthy food. It doesn't address things like food apartheid, food sovereignty, food like food deserts, and it doesn't look at the language around the word healthy to begin with, and who is that language for, and the underpinnings of like racism that is tied to that language. It ignores the idea and excludes the history behind food, right? So like if we're looking at like soul food, for instance, like there's a reason why like certain foods might be heavily salted or like whatever, because that's what people had to do in order to survive, right? And so, you know, when we're, then we get into these spaces where we like penalize and villainize people for not having things that are locally sourced or organic and all these kinds of things without looking at the language that we're reinforcing through systems of a hierarchy that aren't acknowledging all the other ways that like this has impacted me. So, you know, how does that impact me if I'm Black and a woman? And what does that mean for me if I'm Indigenous and land sovereignty? And what does that mean for me if I'm an immigrant or, you know, a refugee? Because I occupy two different spaces that way too as well. Like, what happens if that, when you're having that conversation with me and I'm trans, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, I believe that like for me, everyone has the inherent right to be well, right? We're fighting for that. And so intersectional wellness is a space that we provide in terms of like acknowledging that we need to protect our most vulnerable people, right? And when we do that, like we're therefore by default acknowledging the systemic, institutional, individual oppressions that have impacted our well-being, and seeing intersectionality as an important component and a necessary component in terms of like social justice within the idea of wellness, right? So when I say intersectional wellness, what I'm really trying to say is that I'm asking us as an industry to consider the ways that we create, the ways that we can create a more inclusive version of wellness and how we can advocate for the wellness of all people, not just a few, the mm-hmm. ones that have access and who can afford, but for everybody. And how that when we do that, we actually impact and have a greater reach in terms of everybody's overall well-being. And then by doing this, we're centering and highlighting how injustices, however they show up, are committed against these vulnerable populations, and bringing that to the forefront so we're not minimizing and like ignoring or bypassing social inequity and how it shows up. Mm-hmm. And like my friend Navi Gill always says, like wellness is our sovereignty, right? And so really acknowledging that space of like wellness is our sovereignty and people have the right to be well, And we have to acknowledge the intersectionalities that come into play when we're talking about well-being, because there's so many other variables. And that was just like food, right? Like someone eat healthy, and like there's so many different things that come at play with just like telling someone to eat healthy, where, and you're not acknowledging like the collective histories, traumas, and injustices that have been committed against certain populations. And for me, that's just like, if you're ignoring that, then you're bypassing your and you're not doing the work the right way.
That seems like a really powerful place to end. And but I'm listening to you and I'm like, I know there's going to be people who wonder how they can keep learning with you and from you. Like, where do people learn with you? Where can people connect with you more? Because this is such a huge conversation, yet I know how practical you are in the way that you work with creating wellness spaces that are actually focused on wellness. Where do people find you?
Well, they can find me on social media under Rebecca Price. And on internet, my website, iriseyoga.com. And you know, I'm very accessible, as you know.
Yeah.
In terms of just really reaching out and having conversation. I do have a Patreon account if people want to like support that, and we're doing some more work around unpacking that and doing the work that's related to those pieces in particular. And then I just think that you know, my challenge back to community would be like really finding the ways and identifying how you can be a part of that more collective change, right? And so if there's anything that I would probably want to leave people with is like, you know, yes, you can see me on a panel, or yes, you can engage through my social media, you know, hit me up an email or through my website, but and also just really take the time to really reflect on the ways that you can show up differently, how you can reallocate the resources. We've talked about this, like, you know, I'm just going to plant the seeds, like how can we help heal community and help create, build more equity into our work through like exploring what reparations looks like through our work, the reallocation of resources in terms of when we're thinking about dismantling could also look like, providing space for your expertise to communities that are more vulnerable so that they can then create a different kind of outcome and shift and change. So I want to leave everybody with that reflection piece that I like to do, and then kind of like build from there.
So the idea of reparations is about dismantling, but it's about creation. And you and I have talked a bit about that. Like, what are you choosing to be involved in creating?
I'm choosing to be involved in creating. So I just build equity into all aspects and elements of my work, to the people that I work with. I think that's really important, down to like how I operate and function as a business, like where am I spending my dollars and in what communities in particular. And so like reparations could be something as easy as that, like spending your money in a BIPOC owned business, rather than continuing to center whiteness. I'm looking at really reshaping, rebuilding space in terms of maybe not necessarily physical, because we're still in the pandemic. We don't know what that looks like, but how can we use different like tools and resources, to be able to, show up a lot differently. Like I said before, reparations for me looks like working within the context of community to share the resources and expertise that I have to facilitate change or facilitate pathways for them to create their own lane, which is something that as white people you could do too. And so reparations just looking at yourself as a resource, right? How am I beneficial as a resource? And then how can I use my resourcefulness and be more equitable in my distribution of that resource, right? So like if you're a studio owner, rather than just hiring a Black Indigenous person of color, for instance, maybe you do a lot more work around mentoring them through some sort of pipeline, so then they can then too become a business owner. So not, they're not just an employee, but they're now an employer and employing others from their own community. So just really looking at like reparations as something that's an easy tool and not complicating the language around it so that you can implement it as a practice rather than just verbiage.
Yeah, that conversation, so we aren't done yet, folks, but that conversation really landed for me about the being involved in the creation of something is a really big part of reparations, right? It's what are we dismantling, you know, as white-bodied people, but what are we participating in creating as a result of that too? So that really stuck with me, and I want to thank you so much for that. And that question was more rhetorical in terms of for I know you're involved with creating a lot all the time, and it was more for like to give other people listening pause.
And I think that's important, and like I think that my work through iRise Yoga definitely is reparations, and the work that we collectively do through the Well Collective is a form of reparations. And so, you know, those are two simple examples that people could Google and look up and reach out and find out ways in which they could kind of like shift those narratives rather than, like I said, complicating the language around it and thinking that it's something that's hard to do. Because I think when we complicate processes just because we think that they're complicated, then we really don't really do any effective work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll have all the ways people can find you.
Yes.
In the show notes.
Thank you.
And I'm just so honored to spend this time with you, to find out more about who you are and to sit in the presence of your deeply felt worthiness.
Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate you providing me the space to be able to do that and share my work and from a different angle and lens and provide the space for me to unpack. Because sometimes people just, they just look at it at a very surface level. And, you know, my work is to confront, but not to be confrontational, right? And those are two different spaces that I occupy. Unless you cause me harm, then it might become a little confrontational, but for the most part, it's to confront and really encourage us and to find ways to be able to do that. So I'm really happy that you allowed me the opportunity to talk to you and your audience around the ways that we can confront what we do and how we show up to create change.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.